Perfect Podcast. Welcome to the Almost Perfect Podcast, a celebration of fuck-ups, failures, and falling flat on your face. This is a podcast that believes you can learn from experience, but that experience doesn't have to be your own. Hi, I'm Bob Perfect, and I'm a functional fuck-up. Let's learn from somebody else's mistakes. And today we are learning from Desire Maria. Now, Desire is an icon. I'm just going to say that. But you probably know his work as a musician, although he's very talented in a number of different ways. Desire is someone who is very good at expressing themselves artistically, both visually and audially. Audially, right? Right? Probably. So we chat about a hell of a lot. Desire is also Sangoma. Probably should have mentioned that up front. So we get into that. We learn a lot about that. We discuss gender. We discuss meeting Donatella Versace. We learn all about how Faga came together and how that whole project affected Desire's life. And so much more, which you'll hear in just a little bit. Of course, I need to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by you, which means you can support it by going to patreon.com/almostperfect. With that out of the way, it's now time for the Almost Perfect Podcast with Desire Maria. So how are you living, Desire?
How am I living? I'm living good.
Yeah, it seems like you are. I've gotten to spend a bit of time with you over the last 2 weeks, and it's been quite fun because it's also like interesting to see that the success hasn't gone to your head.
Okay, that's... That's good to hear.
I just love your energy, man. It's mellow. It's just, for someone who I see as, okay, I'm going to start this off on a very, high level. But, as a once-in-a-generation kind of artist, I do genuinely see you like that. It's so interesting to see you, just interact with the world. And, it's such a mellow pace. And, personally, I appreciate that because I've dealt with a lot of musicians and artists who I don't see as being as good as you. Who definitely see themselves as being, a lot more, you got to pay a lot more attention to them. And you don't seem to do that. So I don't know what my question is here.
Thank you so much.
But it has just been really cool to watch you interact and watch you in this space in your life, because I haven't known you well or anything, but I've seen you around over the years and especially back in the day because you were at DUT and then you went to Vega, right? And you were part of the Durban scene, but I had no, you had fucking mad style, but I had no idea what you were capable of. And then to see what's happened since, it's pretty crazy.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been great hanging out with you too, actually. Yeah. Yeah, that's been my Durban for the last couple of weeks, I think. and it was nice reconnecting with Durban with, I think, people who defined Durban in many ways,
It was interesting because I think Sebonelo Gobere came and saw you. He was outside, or was it?
Chairman.
Yeah, the chairman, when we were bouncing out of there, and it was just of course everyone knows everyone,
Yeah.
So has that, because Durban is a small city, but it's also, I guess, it's interesting because you're at an age and I'm at an age where you're kind of seeing people come into their own a lot more. Life is, we were just talking about Fulani Mtembu, who's been doing stuff for years, but it seems at the moment, the opportunities are really opening up for people who have been putting the work for a long time. And I mean, you're a prime example of that. I'm sure you did. You saw your life happening like this, right?
I did. I saw it happening like this, and I see it happening in other ways as well. Yeah.
Is it just been from a young age you were I'm going to do all these things?
Yeah. From a young age. That's the first thing I wanted to do. I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to be very exposed in the work that I did. And it happened. I think what changed maybe was the modalities or the mediums. Because
sure.
I did a lot of things. I started with fine art, then it was acting, then it was fashion, and then advertising, and then music. And then, I'm here now. But yeah, I've always just seen it.
Like you just had like a creative voice inside you?
Yeah. I've always just been a creative person.
So like what are some early memories of like, were you like just drawing, singing, dancing?
I used to draw a lot, like every surface I could get, including walls. So it got me into a lot of trouble. Like I was that kid who drew on walls. Like it was like I'd go into a trance. I know it's wrong. Like I'd be reprimanded the day before. But like now I remember that like it was just getting different memories of like scenes maybe from like even my previous life and the need to just document them as quickly as possible while I'm still young and while I still can download with the same clarity, you know? Yeah, I forgot what the question was.
Just about your creative drive essentially. Yeah. Cause I mean, we're going to jump ahead, I guess, but I imagine some of this ideology or these ideas around it has shifted over the last 2 years since you've had your calling and become a Sangoma, right?
Yeah.
So, like, how has it reshifted everything for you?
You know, it's like, it's shifted a lot, but I wouldn't say that the shift has been that drastic because I think my calling started years before.
I would imagine so. Yeah. Like just from your music, from your art, from the way you express yourself, like, and from my very ignorant understanding of, you know, Isangomas and, you know, that culture, like it does seem like you've always had a connection to the spiritual, at least.
Always. And it was always like a theme in my work, you know, even since I was at school, at college, you know, it was always something that I was just referencing because it felt like the most right thing for me, you know. And obviously that evolved over the years, over growing, you know, and learning more about my spirit and like what role that plays in my work to a point where I was trancing while writing, trancing while making the music, like recording it, trancing on stage, but like not having that language, you know, to know that actually that state was a trance-like state. But for me, it was like, I just want to be one with the work and one with the music and one with that voice. And I felt like at the time it's something that anybody could do. I still believe that, you know, but I didn't think it was something that was attributed to the fact that I am actually a Sangoma waiting to happen, you know. So it's weird. When I did get the calling, even my journey within that calling was like very, I'd use similar methods of like listening just because I value listening a lot, like especially to sound or music, to a point where I won't listen to a lot of music just because I want to listen to myself. And that exercise of listening is something that helped me when I had to listen to all these other voices, you know, my ancestors' voices. It was the same mechanics. So my artistic background helped my spiritual journey, and so did my spiritual journey. So my artistic practice.
I would imagine so. What is the calling like to experience? What is, like, if you can try to talk me through it a little bit. Like, I've watched some documentaries, I've had friends talk to me about this stuff, and it's very fascinating to me, but, like, I've never actually had real conversations with a Sangoma. So what is it like?
It's basically just, like, it's being inducted into a very sacred science faculty, you know?
Yeah.
And
because there's a long tradition of medicine when it comes to being a Sangoma. And like a lot of the medicines that we have over the counter have a lot of the ingredients that come from Sangoma. So that's the thing. I know a lot of like white people who might be listening who haven't like actually done any research might be thinking, oh, but isn't it just magic and spells and this sort of thing? And when you say science, they might be going, huh? But that is the reality of it. It's actually a very long tradition of traditional science, essentially.
It's a long tradition of traditional science, but even the spells, you know, and spells used for light and for healing, that's also a science. And I think that's a very advanced level that I think even like, I think Western science still doesn't have the language for.
No, see, that's the thing. This is where a lot of cultures cross over, you know, in terms of there is a realm, there is another level to life, you know, that like people can interact with. But yeah, with Western culture and Western philosophy and Western science, intentionally cut that out.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's part of the process of Western science to go like, well, we don't know how to describe this, so it doesn't exist.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And saying it shouldn't exist as well, and forcing it and trying to force it, you know, because I think, especially in South Africa, the practice of traditional healing was like, there were legislatures against it at some point. But it's actually, if you look at the amount of healers in this country compared to the entire world, you know, I think we've got a lot, so much that you need to actually take yourself out of seeing it a certain way, you know, viewing it as a science, you know, viewing it as a technology that's literally just maybe part of the country.
Well, this is what like Russell Shangwane said to me, like when I've been talking to him about it, he says like, it's a technology.
Yeah, literally.
It's just, it is harder for me to wrap my head around that side of things, because like the metaphysical is something like I just struggle with, like as a concept in general, you know?
Yeah.
So how does it manifest? Like, you know, like when you talk to ancestors and stuff, or do ancestors come through you? Like what's all of that side of it? Because I know there's different kinds of spirits.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't know what they all are. Yeah.
You know what? It happens differently for different people, you know? And I think maybe there's a frequency that's, I think, the common denominator in whatever way you experience your ancestors. If you see them, you know, or if you see visions or certain things, that's because there's a frequency that's at like a very small, like smaller than molecular level, can then influence space in that way and kind of tell space and tell molecules or like atoms to form certain shapes or certain truths and realities, you know, in the space that we're in. Because we're sitting in this room right now, but we are kind of like in this dense energetic field, you know, and this frequency can come in and hack this thing and make itself appear. And that's a spirit, you know, that's an ancestor, that's maybe that's you, that's your past, whatever it is. But at the same time, you as a person who's a human being, you know, you also have this divine energetic like DNA in you, and different frequencies from different people, you know, like the different spirits can also kind of like go into your body as the hardware, you know, that's channeling basically. But it's just the frequency entering your body and triggering something else to a point where it's literally this person speaking in your body, and your body can facilitate that. That's the science of it, you know. There is this frequency that molds and shapes our molecules, you know, and our cells and every part of like our physical body to become whatever is coming through. So I think a sangoma maybe is someone who can surrender and offer themselves easily to that, you know, or with intention, you know, to heal or to allow certain things that are healing to be said through them, you know. Yeah.
If someone, has someone come to you for healing and you haven't had ancestors come and speak through you or speak to them, or?
You know, it hardly happens, because also my ancestors, of course, people have agency and they make their own decisions. But my ancestors usually bring people that they can actually help, because I'm actually not doing the helping really. But
so you see them as bringing the people to you to help?
They bring the people to me, and it's also those people's ancestors who tell them that that's where we are going to get the help, you know. It's two bloodlines negotiating that.
Okay.
And it's up to us how well we listen to that. But in my experience, everyone who has come has been someone who needed to come.
Like, don't you feel like that's a lot of responsibility? Like, did you want to run away from it at first?
It's got me fucked up. You know, I wanted to. There was nothing actually that made me want to run away. I think it was just who I was. Yeah, it resonated so deeply.
Just made sense.
It just made sense. It's obviously a difficult journey, and there are times where I'm just like, fuck, I can't even resign from this. This job has no HR, you know? Can't serve notice and do something else. It's literally, it's who I am and what I'm doing now. And it's a huge responsibility, but it also fulfills me a lot because it is who I am.
And at the same time, there must be some level of confidence to know you're guided by ancestors, like that you're... paths, like, that's there laid out for you and you can connect with it, right?
You know, that I'm grateful for that, but it's not like I'm guided to a point where I know everything about my life.
Sure.
I don't, because at the same time, it's very important that I live, and I live a life, and I live a human life as well. I think the quality of my life is something that enriches the quality of my healing. So I don't live my life like in any supernatural way, you know. It's always, I might be guided to something, like I might be shown that, okay, this is going to happen, but I still have to, like, you know, I still have to live through it.
You still have to make the choices.
I still have to make the choices, make the mistakes, learn the lessons, you know. I have to live.
I understand that. And how do you balance the... you know, your two lives, I guess, or do you see it as two lives now, with your artistic self versus your healing self, or are they merged together completely?
They definitely bleed into one another right now. They really do. I mean, there are certain things like managing my day, you know, that's how I balance, but it's all very involved for me. It's all very involved. And for a very long time, I've always wanted my music to be something that can heal people. And
and it comes through.
I'm glad. And I think now maybe it's a lot more deliberate and learning of better ways to heal.
I guess we can talk about music a bit then.
Yeah.
Fucker and Desire, like, are so different, like, in terms of sound. Was that, I mean, obviously it's intentional, but what was the thinking behind it? Was it more like, I want to have this big difference, or was Desire just, I don't know, like, what was the process for it?
Desire was literally Desire. That was my voice, like, musically. I wanted to create something in my voice.
Okay.
That was Faga's voice, is also Faga's voice, yeah. You know, and
because I mean, that's still very much you,
like, yeah.
I mean, I would say like Faga's you at night, and then Desire's like you in the day, like a bit more, like, about, you know, like,
bro, yeah, I feel that as well, but I just, yeah, with Desire, I really just wanted to like pioneer something, like a sound, something new. I'd been working on it for years and kind of like just being afraid that it would just be too weird or something.
I mean, it's not too weird. It is weird, but like, it's not too weird. It's weird in all the best ways. But so it was something that you were working on, like, just as a, like, when you say you were working on it, what, like, just at home, like, you know, coming up with beats, coming up with melodies, coming up with ideas, and just, how long was that process? And then when you brought it all together, was it just taking little like samples of stuff and merging them together? Or did you have fully formed songs already and then just had to record them?
With Desire, I had like fully formed songs. Some of them were really old, but they were coming from a time when I was teaching myself how to produce, actually, because I didn't know how to produce, but I knew I needed to produce an album. And I tried to look for people who could like maybe produce for
what
me,
you wanted,
what I wanted. I would meet a lot of talented people as well, but it never just came together in a way that allowed me to work with them in that way. I always had to get the song to come through me first and actually produce on the computer, which was the scariest shit for me because I didn't even know how to operate a door. You know, I started on GarageBand.
Which isn't that friendly.
it's not. I mean, it helped. Shout out GarageBand, actually. But it was at the computers at Vega. I didn't even own a computer at that time. But we had these computer labs with GarageBand.
Yeah, because they use Macs. So, yeah.
They use Macs. And I'd go there sometimes on like Saturdays because they'd open just, you know, if you needed to get schoolwork done. But I'd go there to like record music.
I don't think they mind. Like, I know a lot of Vega kids who use those computers for things that were not Vega work.
Yeah. So, shout out Vega. They didn't know this, but like, I think the first song I made was on a Vega computer. But it was years ago, like maybe 2012. But I would say that was the beginning of Desire because Desire is like the evolution of that voice that was coming through when I was producing, even as a person who didn't know. And then a few years later, I realized, shit, I've been doing this for like almost 10 years and I haven't put anything out. I just have hundreds of these songs. And I revisited a lot of them, I think with maybe the wisdom of hindsight, you know, and I was like, okay, this is actually what I've been wanting to say. And then I composed everything, made it into an album, recorded vocals. And then I invited like co-producers as well, like Sanele Ngubane, Pasha, Tabang Snyder, Neo Hlasko.
Yeah. So you said Nonku Perry.
Nonku Perry as well. Yes, on vocals. And it was just very a very organic process as well, because it wasn't like,
None of those people have egos as far as I know. So like it's
no, they don't.
Like everybody mentioned it, like it's all the same like kind of energy as you. Like, you know, I would imagine they'd be easy to work with and like, you know, it would be a cool flowing process.
It was so easy to work with them. You know, they were very supportive towards me. They were, I think I was struggling a lot at that time as
really?
Well. Yeah, struggling. Like 2019, just a lot was happening. But
get into it just now.
Yeah. But they really like showed me the way, or like reminded me of myself, you know? Especially Nonku. You know? Nonku also.
Nonku, get back to me, please.
I hope she does.
No, I know we'll eventually chat. If it's this year, next year, 10 years time, I'll get her on the podcast. It's all good.
I know you will. Nonku, Hlasko, Sanele Ngubane, those people, wow. They literally just came into my life. They were in my life, but like at that time, they were just like in it with me.
It's also what I like about this whole process is something that like, a lot of artists don't go through, and that like, you know, especially these days and especially with social media and the way how easy it is to put music out, people will put out their first song, you know, and like now everyone knows like what your first song sounded like and they can write you off immediately. But like if your first album comes 10 years into making music, it's, you know, you've got a lot better, and you had like a whole other project and like, mm-hmm. traveled the world, like, you know, met lots of people, had an understanding of what you were doing. So it's like the perfect time for it as well, which is why I think like as a debut album, it's like fucking, you know, one of the best. It is. It's just like it's super, super high up there. Like, I mean, especially in South Africa, but I mean, I'm talking just generally, like as debuts go, like it's very hard to beat that. So
thank you so much. Yeah.
But I feel like if you'd done it 10 years earlier, I wouldn't be saying that. Maybe your whole career would have been different.
Maybe it would have been different. Maybe I should be grateful that I waited, you know?
I don't know. I think there's value in doing stuff when you're young and practicing and stuff like that. But like, send it to your friends, you know, get their opinions more than just like put out the first stuff. I feel like we've got a weird culture these days that everyone wants approval for everything that they do. Like, so like you make one small little thing and you put it on Instagram and like, maybe just keep that thing, you know, maybe do another thing, maybe do another thing, and then maybe have an exhibition. Like, you know, that's, and like, to me, like Desire seems like the exhibition of like all the little bits of like doodles that you had for years.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Literally was.
So how did Fucker come about? Because that was a fucking crazy project. Like, I really, like, I loved watching you guys perform. It was wild.
Yeah, no. Fucker was just, we were best friends, you know, and we were so inspired by culture, so inspired by Gom, so inspired by South Africa, so inspired by Black people.
Brenda Fassie,
like Lebo Matshosa. Like, we mentioned them a lot, but a lot of other people. Because, like, Fela and I used to just sit sometimes and, like, watch random gospel music videos.
On SABC One?
On YouTube, you know? But sometimes on SABC One, you know?
When I used to bug school, like, that would be my musical education from, like, 10 until 1 on, like, SABC One. You would just have the wildest selection of music videos. Like, yeah. It would just be, like, it would go all over the show. Like, you would start out with, like, hip-hop and then go into Maskandi, go into gospel. It was, yeah, for me, it was an education.
It literally... That's good education. SABC One is good education for a lot of us. They need all the credits, actually.
Izo,
you know.
Jam Alley.
Look. Street Journal, Take Five.
Take Five, yeah. Sheesh.
There was just so much. There was just a whole lot. Yo TV even was like, the programming and the conversations they were having were so, I think they were so empowering. If you look at South African youth right now, like the people who are maybe late 20s, early 30s, you know, they've got this kind of conviction, but like this conviction driven by information or like a certain kind of outlook that I think I would attribute to like SABC's programming in that time. It was brilliant.
It really was. Yeah. And that actually is a super important thing that I think people don't necessarily think about when it comes to culture, and that is just how much what you have access to matters, and like having the right people in the positions of programming and stuff like that. Because like I, you know, understand the history of like the BBC pretty well because of stuff like Monty Python and like British comedy in general. And that was only capable because you had the right people saying, put those people on TV, and then that impacts culture generally. But then when you've got the wrong people in charge and they're busy just trying to not even push the envelope, because that's the thing that was so cool about programming like on SABC One, like especially like when we were growing up, it was like Yizzle was like, for me, like life-changing.
Yeah,
like genuinely, like it made me see the country in a completely different way. Like I didn't know like anything, and then you watch that and it's just like, holy
so iconic.
Shit.
So it's like, I feel like what Euphoria is doing for like the kids right now.
Yeah, like,
you know.
Well, yeah, we were kind of talking about that.
Yeah, we were. I think I said Euphoria's Model C is a Izzo or something.
Yeah, that's accurate. But yeah, so you guys were watching gospel videos.
Yeah. Gospel videos, like just everything, like Sotsukazia. We were just into a lot of things, and also into fashion, and also going to like galleries for free wine, but also actually like looking at the art and experiencing and engaging it.
Yeah, unfortunately, in Durban, there's only the once a month Tuesday at the Gay
Sorry, you guys. Maybe people would be happier if there were more galleries to hop. But yeah, that's how Fagga started. You know, we were just friends, and we were passionate about a lot of the same things. Passionate about each other, passionate about the kids, and what we wanted the kids to experience from artists who were around. You know, I think we felt very responsible for the youth, like especially queer youth. You know, in ways that were so truthful, and that felt so right. And it was inevitable for Faga to be something that changed our lives, because I feel like I've done a lot of things, but that was one of the few things done with such pure intention. And seeing just how valuable and how far pure intentions can propel you, you know, if you maintain them in your work. So
yeah. Really like that. Yeah, and I mean, it did. It came through in everything. Like, it was just pure passion. Like, I could see it. And it just seemed like just such a fun project to also create. So, are you guys still going to be doing stuff together, like, down the line? Or
we might, you know, we might. I think right now we're engaging ourselves, you know, our individual voices, which I think is a healthy thing for us right now, in the event that we did come back and do stuff together. Knowing that we have processed a lot of things in our individual journeys and come into ourselves fully, so that wherever we meet again and whatever we share is of like a higher value, even not to quantify it, but just so that it's the same kind of pureness. And yeah.
Was that why you got stopped? Because you lost that pureness for a bit? Or
I mean, you could say that, you know. I think maybe pureness escaped the things that we were doing as well.
Because I can imagine, like, it's a whirlwind journey that you two went on together. And I can imagine that is taxing in lots of different ways. It's rewarding in lots of different ways. And it's just, especially you're so young, like, when it's all happening. And it's, like, so much responsibility in a lot of different ways. So, yeah, I can just imagine what. I can only imagine, because it's such a once in a lifetime experience to go through, and to have someone else to go through it with you.
It is, you know, it's life changing. It's life changing.
Literally.
And
speaking of which, you're going to be playing with Grace Jones soon.
Yeah. We're playing at a festival that's curated by her, Meltdown in London.
Yeah.
And very excited about that. But
there's some interesting names on that lineup.
Very interesting names. I hope I can get to see some of them. You know? But yeah, also playing a lot of other shows. I'm still going to announce.
Sure.
Probably when this comes out, it's going to be announced. But yeah, I will be touring Europe and playing a lot of other shows around that time. It's a very exciting time. I'm touring with a band, you know.
And, nice.
It's like, really? Here now?
Who are you rolling with? Like, do you know? Have you picked them, or is it?
Yeah, all of them are icons. So, Spusiso Mash Mashilwane, he's on keys and piano. He's from Durban. Brilliant. Oh my God. Like, brilliant. I've been working with him since 2020.
Okay.
He like gets the music in like such a deep way. I can't even describe it, but I'm very grateful for him. And then I'm working with Sbu Zondi as well, who's like a legendary drummer. Like, I think in music spaces people know him. Like, he's just like iconic. And I think with the drum sequences in my music, I've never seen anybody be able to like
pull them off,
you know? And he just does it, you know? And we've got Porsha Sibiya, and she's on bass. Brilliant, like brilliant also. The most interesting like person, in my opinion, in the band, you know. She's got like, she's just such a different person. She's a star, you know. And you know when stars are just like so okay with just being themselves.
Yeah. Like, nobody just saw me pointing to Desire, but yeah, I know exactly what that's like.
It's like nodding on the phone, like, are you okay? But, yeah, Porsche is amazing. And then there's Andre van Veek on guitar.
Okay.
He's just brilliant. He plays on a lot of different projects, including The Wretched.
I don't think I've heard his work, but I have heard his name.
Yeah. No, he's amazing.
He was on what? Wretched?
The Wretched.
The Wretched.
With Gabby and I forgot the other dude. But he's brilliant. He tears. And then Sanele Nkobani as well, who like doubles as everything. That guy is like the heart of the band.
He's a multi-instrumentalist, but he's a producer mostly, right?
A producer.
Okay.
He's a producer. And he's one person who understands my music better than anybody. Better than me, actually, you know, because for real.
Because he can see the vision. Like
He can see the vision and he can hear it, you know.
You come with this and that and he's like, why don't we do this? And you're like, yes.
Yeah, not, you know, in that sense, yes as well. But like even if I've composed a song in its entirety, when it's time to like compose live versions of the song or to translate it into like live things.
He understands how that'll translate.
He understands exactly how that will translate. He hears even like the nuances that I didn't hear, because I guess when I'm making the music, I'm kind of like in a trance state, you know, and I'm like here and I'm like, shit, like, how do I even communicate this to people? But Sanele does that so well. And he does that. He also co-composes with me, co-writes, produces together as well. And he sings back up when we tour.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So I assume management has helped a lot with getting you to this position, because being able to tour with a band means someone is negotiating for you, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, management helped a lot, but I also think I don't want people to get the wrong perceptions, you know?
I mean, I'm not like dismissing your work or anything. Obviously, your work's like great and like it's been years of hard work. I'm just saying there's people who are talented who don't get where they need to go because there isn't anyone having conversations for them, I guess.
Yeah. It helps to have somebody who has the conversations with you and for you as the artist to have the conversations with, because, you know, having a manager helped me to just be convicted about what I was seeing, what my vision was, what I wanted, and knowing that somebody was going to negotiate and make that happen for me. But I don't want to give artists the impression that it's a manager who's going to take you there. It's actually you. You have to want that for yourself and know maybe what the sacrifices are, because it did come with sacrifices to be able to accommodate and fly out like 8 people out of the country, you know. It's a huge sacrifice, you know.
I mean, you take a cut.
I'm taking the cut. We could have done this like with 2 people, like a DJ and myself on vocals and earning a whole lot more. But
it's not the right thing.
It's not the right thing. There's a certain kind of integrity that I wanted to be retained in the music, in it happening live, in it being 8 people who are like one and they're connected by something, and that's the music. That's such a beautiful, strong thing for me that I feel like when it hits a person's consciousness, that thing can make you live.
Yeah.
You know? It can make you live. It can make you, it can heal you. It can like reconfigure you entirely. And that's what I wanted. That's what I want. And I wouldn't have gotten that if I didn't actually say so and insist on getting what I want, you know. Insist in every area also. Insist with my management team. Insist with my ancestors as well. Insist with myself where I needed to.
I need to do that a bit more.
Myself accountable. I need to do it more too.
Yeah. Like, I'll insist with myself in the morning, but by the evening, the insistence gets a little lower. Like, it's just like in the morning, like, I'll be like pretty strong-minded about, like, you know, my mantras and like who I am, what I want to do, and like, you know, be goal-driven. And then like as the day goes by, it's like, and I've done like more and more work, and like it's like, maybe I should play a game now, you know. It's like, no, you've got a goal, you want to achieve it. It's like, oh, but 10 minutes, like,
yeah. You know, yeah. You should just play the game, man.
that's where I'm at this point in my life, to be completely honest with you. Like, well, we were actually kind of chatting about this the other day when Paige was taking photos of you. Like, I started off saying that, you know, like, I've been working on my desires, you know, like on the concept of desiring stuff. And, you know, because of my interactions with like Zen philosophy and stuff like that. And you were saying you've got some interesting thoughts on it. Have you been able to come to terms with them yet?
I have, you know, because I feel like the desiring is like imagining, you know, you're imagining something that's not there. You have to imagine it in order to realize. Yeah. But just realize that you desire it. It's something that you'd like. You have to imagine and see it in your life and what value it can add. And imagination is a huge, huge, probably the foundation of like what manifesting is, you know?
Sure.
So I think, yes, we should manage our desires, but like, the act of desire is such an energetically charged thing, you know.
See, so the way I see it is that, yeah, imagining stuff is fantastic, but it's when it gets in the way, like, of everything else. Like, so for me, I can become pretty myopic about things and pretty ego-driven. So desires can take on pretty negative forms. And mm-hmm. if I don't achieve, you know, certain things, and I think that's also the big problem is ambition. And like, I've got those kind of issues of just reconciling ego and ambition and like, you know, what do I really want? Because, you know, I think, well, for so long, I thought I wanted a certain life. And now that I'm living a different life, I realize I actually want this more. It's like, I don't necessarily want to be like, you know, on TV, like as a TV presenter kind of, you know, stand-up comedian kind of guy, the everyman that everyone likes, you know, like when there was like a period where it was like, I wanted to be like known and famous. And now I'm like, that sounds like a lot of fucking work. Like, that sounds stressful. Everyone I talk to that like has like a public-facing life, you know, where people like really know them and like, that just doesn't sound like the kind of life I want to live. And it's like, I can still do good comedy without like wanting that, you know? And it's like more about coming to terms with, oh, the thing you actually want to do is create work that matters to people.
Yeah.
Whereas before I thought like I wanted people to know who I was. And like, it's shifting those sorts of things, I guess, in my own mind. And like, yeah, just trying not to desire like unhealthy things, I guess.
Yes, it's about maybe desiring. It's
the wrong word, but it's just that's what it's used in the Eastern philosophy, you know, is to like in terms of meditation and like, yeah.
Because I guess like what I'm learning from what you're sharing right now is that, yes, maybe creating meaningful work will get you famous.
Maybe.
And I'm sure if it does, you'll still be fine because you manifested that by desiring something of such a higher vibration. You just wanted to create work that matters to people. You know, it wasn't just like, you want to do it for the fame. Because if you want to do it for the fame, then like, you're like, you're Mac G, you know? You'd do anything.
Yo, now we're going to get the hate.
You know?
I'm with you. I mean, that's very much how I've been feeling about a lot of stuff. I've actually, I'm doing a panel discussion this week, which would have been yesterday when people are listening to this, but one of the things I want to talk about is that like even like with podcasting, I mean, this is a very simple version of it, but there's so much possibility with what you can create when the goal isn't just to promote yourself. When the goal is to actually create something valuable for people, you can do so much more. But what we've got at the moment is a culture that is very much focused on look at me, look at me, look at me. And that's not, it's like, cool, we're looking, but what are you offering? You know? And a lot of the time it's just controversy or it's just like, it's low hanging fruits and lowest common denominator stuff. And I just, So I don't want to be a part of that essentially, because also in the comedy scene, I see a lot of it and I see a lot of people who are talented going down paths that aren't them, or maybe it is them, you know, maybe that is what they want. But I do feel like society does impact what we desire as well, yeah. You know, and what we want. And our current culture especially is very media driven, and it is very
exhausting.
Although for you, it's a big part of your life as well. Like, being seen is a part of the job, like being put in different magazines and all of that. How much work do you put into that? Or do people just approach you?
I usually get approached. I mean, now I do have a PR agent for like releases, and they do the work. Previously, I did it myself.
So what was that? Just getting blog, like email addresses and just sending everything out? Like that, like the old school way of just getting like following journalists, or
I would stalk. I would follow journalists that like read like the Feira and like see the journalist's name and look for them on Twitter, Instagram.
I like that you went with the Feira, like you were like Mahala. I like that you went with the Feira, like to try and get in touch with them and not like Mahala, like a lot of...
No, Mahala is iconic.
I'm just saying, like there's levels, you know? Yeah. And like, it's cool that you shot like there. Because I mean, you're on Pitchfork.
Also via stalking them and stalking Ruth Saxelby, the journalist, you know? Yeah, that's how that happened. But I guess, yeah, I have just always gunned for things that maybe would feel beyond me sometimes. And I think like my manager's getting used to it now. My entire team. Because I'll aim very high.
But it's also like everything that like has happened is kind of like, well, yeah, of course, whatever you're aiming for next is going to happen. I mean, you fucking like walked with Donatella Versace, right? Or like, I know you met her, and like, yeah, like, well, tell me that story, please. Because that was fucking... When I saw that photo, I was just like, that must have been for you just like a crazy, crazy moment.
Crazy moments, crazy dream come true. Like, Fela and I met and we instantly became best friends. But I was at that time studying fashion and...
DU too?
No, at UJ.
Oh, shit. Okay, cool. Yeah. So you're up there then?
I was up there, yes. And I used to watch FTV all the time.
Like, same, in my spare time. For different reasons. As a young boy, there's two reasons why you're watching FTV. One's because you're straight, one's because you're not.
Well, I hope it contributed somehow, you know.
Oh, definitely. Like, no, I've got an appreciation. My style's not great, but I like other people's.
Yeah. No, look, you know, I watched it for, I mean, I love the fashion, but mostly also the music. And there was this song. Yep, definitely. And there was no Shazam back then.
Yeah.
And it was the most frustrating thing because there was this one song, Blind by Hercules and Love Affair. It played at the spring summer 2009 Versace fashion show.
Did you have that recorded?
The show?
Yeah.
I didn't have, in my mind, it was recorded.
Okay.
Like, I was an encyclopedia of shows. I'll tell you, no, this is from spring summer like 01 or something. But Tato had that song on their phone when we met, and I was like, oh my god, you're the only other person in the entire planet who knows the song. And it's the song that played on the Versace fashion show, and it was just so luxurious, right? So luxurious. The energy was just so amazing. And that moment ended up introducing me to one of my favorite vocalists, Anoni. You know, and well, fast forward to like 9 years later, and now we're like at the Versace mansion in Milan, and it's our music now that's being played. And now it's like other kids who are gonna maybe watch the show and be like, oh my gosh, what is this song? And maybe connect, you know. And it's, yeah, that's the beauty for me. You know, obviously it was very nice. It was like, they took care of us, you know, it was nice to meet my heroes, like the makeup artist, Pat McGrath, and like Donatella. But
what was Donatella like? Like, was it awkward or was she friendly? What is she like as a person?
She was very friendly. She smells very nice.
I can imagine.
She's quite smart. She's got a way with words.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Quite witty.
I wouldn't say witty, but I think just very poetic when she talks about fashion.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very like she believes it, you know.
You just get to drink that energy in for a bit.
Yeah. It's very nice. It's so nice to witness. That's my favorite thing. To see passionate people being passionate about what they're passionate about.
Yeah.
You know, and like being loud about it and being poetic. They don't care if it looks like silly to other people, but they will be like, no, it's contemporary, you know, and it's and they believe it. And I love that so much.
Okay, cool. Got about 10 minutes left, so I've got like two more things I want to ask you. The one thing is about gender, because I see your pronouns on Twitter are he, him, and then also, what is the Zulu word? I think it's for God. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. It's for God.
Okay. But then I see in a lot of press stuff that you like are referred to as they, them. So has that been a journey? Like, what's the process? Or?
Yeah, it has been a journey. It has been a journey with like gender, you know. And I then realized I don't want to define myself in any other language except isiZulu.
Okay.
You know? So that's why I define myself as Ismagate. No, they aren't necessarily pronouns that maybe are adjacent to that enough in English. So he, him is fine.
Okay.
I've come to just a point where I'm like, for me, it doesn't really matter like that part, just as long as I can define myself, you know, in my own language and I'm not defining myself maybe in English.
Sure. But it's also you define yourself beyond language. Like, you know, you utilize like I assume gender and gender expression are things that you are through fashion and through music and through culture able to, I don't know, just be in touch with a bit more, like, then I don't know, like, yeah, it's just interesting, because it's also, so one of my issues, I guess, with all of it is even the they, them stuff, it's still very binary in a way, like it boxes people in, like just pronouns in general. And I very much appreciate when people are non-binary and prefer to go by it, and I'll use whatever pronouns you want me to use, you know, but I also find it's, you're still defining yourself by other people's language. And you still define like gender in that way, especially for me, because obviously I am a guy, you know, like I'm a dude, but there's fluidity to it as well, just on different spectrums for everyone, I guess. And it's as much as you want to express it and as much as you want to, get in touch with it, I guess. I don't know.
You know, it's, for me, it's like the language, those distinctions are very important for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I don't want to invalidate them at all in me choosing to identify the way I do. You know, people who identify as non-binary or non-conforming, who prefer to be referred to with they, them pronouns or whatever pronouns that they feel best represent them. I feel like that is a very important exercise, you know.
Definitely.
And like affirming yourself in a world that only makes space for two. I think maybe having wider categories, you know, that account for the nuances and the tiny details in people's experiences are also quite important. But for me, you know, that nuance and that exercise has led me to like ngismagate, and I honestly would like to not define or like describe that experience in any other way, you know, in any other language.
Cool. I'm glad we're going to chat about it, because I was interested, because I do just see like you being referred to as they, them in all press at the moment, so I was just wondering,
because previously I did make it a thing to say I'm either he or they, you know. Okay. And
And what was that process like, though? For, because you were saying, like, you know, it is important for people to find the language to define them. So when you were thinking over there, what was the thinking behind it?
I think that I didn't necessarily, like, I could escape the constructs of gender, you know. I didn't have to think within them when it came to me.
Yeah.
But I can also escape the constructs of gender outside of, or like within he, him pronouns right now.
Because that's kind of, okay, that's exactly my thinking around it with you, is that like, well, with when I saw the he, him, and when I was trying to think about this stuff, was that like, just because you identify as he, him, or, you know, masculine, or masculine, because he, him doesn't have to be masculine, then that's essentially what I'm saying, is you can still present however you want. Like,
I can.
Like, that's the thing. You can wear any clothes, all the makeup, anything. It doesn't matter, and still present as however you want. And I think that's important as well. It's like, I think, yeah, that to me is just why, like, this stuff is very interesting, and it's very important for people to figure it out for themselves, I guess.
Yeah. And that's exactly it. I can do whatever and still identify as, or like, use the pronouns that I prefer.
Yeah. You know?
And anybody can do that.
Cool. And then the last question of the podcast, it's a new thing I've been doing, is, so everyone gets asked this, is, what is a big mistake that you've made in your life that you learned a really important lesson from? You can either focus on the lesson or the mistake in telling the story.
I think the lesson... The biggest mistake that I've made was not constantly not choosing myself.
Okay.
Yeah. And I guess the lesson is to choose myself.
That's, but like, when is this? Because like, when I, but also, I mean, I see you from the internet and stuff like that, but like, it seems like you've been choosing yourself a lot. So when haven't you chosen yourself?
In a lot of ways, you know, in a lot of, maybe relationships that weren't choosing me back.
Okay.
Careers that were not choosing, or they were choosing me, but like for my labor, but they were not choosing me financially, you know.
Advertising.
Yeah. They were not choosing my worth.
Yeah.
They were choosing my work. You know, I think I wish I had chosen myself a lot more. Because had I chosen myself, you know, I would have negotiated better things and better situations for myself.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think that was rooted in a lot of like maybe imposter syndrome, or like just maybe not viewing myself as anyone who matters that much, you know.
When was this?
Hey!
For up like, until yesterday.
No, it's like a huge portion of my adult life has been learning different variations of this lesson.
Yeah.
And even now I'm like, I'm learning how to choose myself better, being better at choosing myself and choosing better, you know, choosing better and making a better self to choose, you know. Because, like, what's the point of choosing, like, an asshole?
Yeah, I think I chose myself a lot in my 20s, but not, like, in a good way. But, yeah, for me, growing up's definitely become a bit of that process as well. Of just, yeah. And it's also, like, I don't know, I feel, like, less of an imposter these days because I'm doing less things that are, like, put me in a position to feel like that, you know, like I'm pretty confident about a lot of the stuff I do, except for the next time I get up on stage and do stand-up comedy, because it's been far too fucking long.
I'm sure you'd be good.
I might. It's one of those things where
you never know.
Yeah, I don't like to predict that. Actually, I do want to know, what happened in 2019 before we go?
What happened?
Yeah. If you want to talk about it.
You know what? I'll talk about it. I think. Because I like, I'm a private person, but also there are certain experiences for me that I know would help someone. You know, I was I was going through a lot of betrayal, heartbreak, loneliness in my personal relationships. Also my relationship with Joburg, the city, and the relationship with my work was like falling apart, you know. We were doing amazing, but like we were also doing terribly at the same time, and it wasn't making sense. I know what was happening now because there were so many different factors, even the facts of my calling and the fact that I had to like eventually move back home, you know, in preparation for that journey. It contributed to how messy that year was for me, and also being in the wrong place and doing the wrong things, like the wrong type of work, even though it was right maybe a year or two ago. When it starts being wrong, everything is wrong. So everything was wrong for me. And it was just that situation taking me out, and I needed to step into a different part of my greatness, I guess.
And since then, how do you feel?
I'm recovering from that, because since 2019, it's just been a lot of like just
one thing after another.
One thing after the other. Like one thing after the other.
Not even just personally, just globally.
Yeah, even globally, definitely. So I really don't know. I don't know. It'll make sense though. It'll make sense. I'm grateful because I see it going somewhere. But yeah.
Yeah. I can relate in some ways, you know, like sometimes those moments like take a long time to recover from, but like what comes out of it is usually a lot of resolve and a lot of like you come out stronger, but it can take quite some time.
It can take some time. And you know what? Like as much as it's irritating and like I wish it could make sense sooner. I know when life does that thing where things make sense and like
it's like clarity.
Yeah.
When
you get clarity, even if it takes 5 years, when it comes, man, it's so glorious. You know, it's like when your time comes, like when your success comes after working for like 10 years, you know, and you finally get that like big break and it all makes sense. When it does come, it's beautiful. So I'm okay with not knowing until that moment comes.
I think we're going to end things there. Thank you so much.
Thanks, bro.
So that was Desire. Yo, what a great chat. I learned so much. I really did. And I'm so grateful to Desire for, I don't know, just being so gracious with an ignorant, straight white boy, I guess. Yeah, I feel like I didn't necessarily articulate all my thoughts properly there, but it's cool. It's not about me anyway. Besides, the whole point is to learn and grow, and I definitely learned and grew from that conversation. I hope you did too. How you doing? I'm not really sure what's actually been happening in the world this week. Has anything happened? I'm sure stuff's happening. Prices are going up, right? Wages are going down, same as it's always been. But I hope you're feeling good. I hope that conversation genuinely just helped you make your week a little bit better. Even if you were having a good week, now you're having an even better week. Yeah, I've just been chilling. Well, I haven't been chilling. I've been working. I've been busy. I've been in the lab, you know, with a pen and a pad and all of that. Because today, when you are hearing this, if you're hearing this on the Friday, I will be a part of a panel discussion, but I've also got to give a little 10-minute talk beforehand at the Quandafest, which is happening at the station in Durban, which by the time you're hearing this, I would have already done the chat and the talk, but I've been preparing for that. I've also been organizing other guests and just getting some admin done in various different ways. So I've been keeping to myself. I haven't been in anybody else's business lately. So I don't have much to report this week, I am afraid. What have I been watching? Oh, I finally got around to American Vandal Season 2, which was probably better than Season 1. Probably better. Although because of season one, you know, there were some things that were a little bit more predictable. And yeah, but anyway, if you want to watch a good mockumentary parody on the whole true crime series that isn't afraid to be gross and disgusting and at the same time quite full of social commentary and reflects on modern society, I guess. So I watched that, and oh yeah, we went to Tiger's Milk on Saturday night. Paige and I went to support Leah Jasmine from 5FM, but also from being my friend for quite a long time. So she was in town and wanted to go support, and it was interesting because I didn't know the rest of the lineup. I knew Leah was playing, so I was like, let's go. Well, Paige was like, let's go. And I was like, yeah, let's go, obviously. But had I looked at the lineup, I might not have gone. Because, I can't believe that in 2022 I have to see December Streets. I mean, I didn't have to. But I did. And, you know, my life is worse off for it. I had been on a whole kick of, like, you know, really being selective about the events I go to. Make sure I see good music and good bands. And then I didn't. Oh, no. But Leo said it was good. Genuinely. I didn't even know she was DJing. Like, we were having a smoke and couldn't see who the DJ was. And I even said to Paige, I was like, ah, this is a good set. And then we went there and I was like, ah, it's Leo. And we danced. And it was good. And then December Streets played. And other people danced, at least. There were people who had a good time. And I won't say I didn't have a good time, because I did. It just wasn't to the music. It's been a while since I've been a hater. But it's also like, I just feel like COVID could have ended a few more bands. Like, I feel like the wrong bands died. But as we know, in South Africa, as long as you can create a song with a chorus that people can sing along to, you are going to be eating for quite some time. Yeah. So that's the vibe, I guess. I want to thank Absolute Shredder Damien Root for the intro music and for the wonderful bed music you hear underneath me. And of course, I want to thank everyone over at patreon.com/almostperfect, but in particular, the titular titles tier, which is a $10 tier that allows you to pick your title right here on the Almost Perfect podcast. So shout out to Neil Green, who is the key grip, Vashendra Naidu, our spiritual advisor, Riz Ventura, our director of purchasing, Julian, our king, Karan Sleman, the Almost Perfect hedge fund manager, Russell Grant, our Far East correspondent, Karan Chetty, our assistant to the regional manager, Catherine Jenkin, the inevitable ruler of the universe, and Queen Swifty, chief sales officer of Subtle Heresies in the greater Overberg region, Rousseau, executive producer Stephen Olafia, and our anonymous benefactor. Of course, I'd also like to thank you for listening all the way through to the end, and I will catch you on the flip side. Like, share, and subscribe!